You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
It's obviously a great honor to be able to introduce both Aryeh Nair and Ian Bruma for a celebration of Aryeh's new book that came out just last month on Princeton University Press on the history of the international human rights movement. Ian, many of whom in this audience is a sort of well-known person, Ian is the Luce Professor of Democracy, Human Rights, and Journalism at Bard College, finishing a fellowship as well at the Coleman Center of the New York Public Library, where he's writing a book called Life in Ruins about the immediate aftermath of World War II in Asia and Europe. Ian, of course, is the author of numerous books. I will not take the time to go through all of them, but it's a great pleasure to have him as an interlocutor with Aryeh tonight. Aryeh himself, what can words say, has been president of the Open Society Foundations since 1993, served for 12 years before that as the executive director of Human Rights Watch, of which he was a founder now some 35 or so years ago in 1978. He had worked for 15 years before that at the American Civil Liberties Union. And it's a great pleasure to be able to be here and celebrate his new book. One very small personal note, I should say I had the honor and the responsibility, I guess, of reading Aryeh's book in draft form over my Christmas holiday in 2010. And as many of you would probably understand, the responsibility of having to provide some interpretive, exegetical critique of a book on the history of human rights by Aryeh is a task not for the faint-hearted. And it reminded me constantly, of course, of that scene in Annie Hall where Marshall McLuhan pops out of the wings to tell that Columbia professor how he knows nothing, absolutely nothing about his work. Aryeh was far more gracious in my limited commentary and critique. So, one point that I'd like to make is that this is being recorded, so those of you who will ask questions subsequent to the conversation, those will be recorded not just for posterity, but for podcast. Aryeh and Ian will speak now for roughly 45, 50 minutes. We will then open it up to questions subsequently.
Okay, so. And I suggested that I should start by giving you a précis of the book, so I will try to boil down I think about 125,000 words into about 15 minutes. It is intended as a history of the international human rights movement. And I think there is some controversy as to when the human rights movement developed and how it developed. And I stake out a particular position on that subject. I suggest that what we know today as the international human rights movement is of fairly recent origin, that essentially it developed in the 1970s, that it certainly had precursors. There were important precursors in terms of efforts to protect rights. For example, the religious dissenters in 17th century England were very preoccupied with rights, but they were not concerned with rights across national boundaries, and they were primarily concerned with their own rights. I think that something more analogous to the contemporary human rights movement emerged in the second half of the 18th century in England with the effort to end slavery. And because slavery was international, inherently that movement was concerned with matters that went across borders. That is, slaves were transported from one place to another. And also, a number of the people who were concerned with the effort to end slavery were not focused on their own rights. They were focused on the rights of others. And the altruistic character of the anti-slavery movement seems to me to make it the most important precursor of the contemporary international human rights movement. There were various efforts in subsequent periods to protect rights internationally. A number of efforts during the 19th century concerned with particular abuses. For example, in the 1870s, what were referred to as the Bulgarian horrors, in which Gladstone in England led protests against the Ottoman Turks for their oppression of the Bulgarians. But I suggest that that was in part because it was Muslims persecuting Christians, and therefore it had a particular resonance in England. In fact, I think that many historians agree that it propelled Gladstone into the position of Prime Minister, replacing his longtime rival Disraeli, who had not spoken out forcefully against what were called the Bulgarian horrors. Any rate, bringing it up to the 1970s, I think the critical factor that helped to establish an international human rights movement was the Cold War context in which it emerged. Because I think the Cold War had the effect of magnifying the importance of certain developments during that period. Starting in the 1960s, there had been a number of persons in the Soviet Union who organized protests dealing with rights. They were a handful, but the international press and the public at large paid a great deal of attention to them because they were challenging the power of the Soviet state. At a somewhat earlier period, I think the conflict between East and West had sometimes been portrayed in economic terms rather than in terms of concern about political repression. If you look at today's New York Times, on the second page of the arts section, there is that famous photograph of Richard Nixon debating Khrushchev in front of the kitchen. And the triumph of the West was meant to be exemplified by Nixon's ability to point to the labor-saving devices in the kitchen. So that was considered to be the nature of the Cold War contest. But that shifted, and I think it shifted principally under the influence of some of the philosophers of the period, and some of the novelists of the period, ranging, you know, from the early post-World War II period, George Orwell, up to much later, Alexander Solzhenitsyn. At any rate, there was this attention to the Soviet dissent, disproportionate attention given the relative handful of people, but it achieved importance because of the immense attention that was paid to it. But the United States in particular, which had tried to exemplify liberty in standing up to the Soviets, was itself vulnerable. And its vulnerability was its support of repressive regimes in different parts of the world, in Latin America, in Asia, in Africa. The United States supported a variety of anti-communist regimes. And another part of the human rights movement particularly crystallized around the Pinochet coup on September 11, 1973, and the support of the of Pinochet by the Nixon administration during that period. Another development during that period was the effort on college campuses in the United States to impose sanctions on South Africa. That was probably the first effort in which substantial numbers of persons in this country were involved in an international human rights issue. And always in the United States, what prompted involvement in human rights was the involvement of the United States. That is, Americans didn't protest against abuses in other countries. They protested against the role of Americans in facilitating abuses in other countries. So after the Soweto riots of 1976 and the murder of Steve Biko shortly after the Soweto riots, the movement to for disinvestment in South Africa took off in the United States. Somewhat later on, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher were the principal opponents of disinvestment and sanctions on South Africa, but the movement in this country was strong enough so that congressional legislation imposing sanctions on South Africa was adopted over Ronald Reagan's veto. At any rate, so the human rights movement, on the one hand, was denouncing Soviet abuses because of the attention to Soviet dissenters and thereafter dissenters in Czechoslovakia and Poland. Then it was denouncing the United States in particular for its support of repressive regimes in different parts of the world. And I think the mainstream of the human rights movement was quite clear in opposing both kinds of abuses of human rights, both the Soviet bloc abuses and the abuses by anti-communist dictatorships in various countries that were supported by the United States. And I think the human rights movement ended up playing a very significant part in the efforts that it made in that period. In the 1980s, between 1983 and 1990, virtually every dictatorship in Latin America was overturned and replaced by a democratic or a more or less democratic government. The only exception, in fact, was Cuba. But Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Uruguay, Paraguay, Central American countries, all had dictatorships replaced by something more democratic and something significantly less abusive of rights than the regimes that had existed previously. Something of the same sort happened in East Asia, that is, the Philippine dictatorship of Marcos came to an end in 1986. The Korean military dictatorship in 1987, Taiwan underwent democratic change during that period. And then, of course, somewhat later on, South Africa had the transition from the apartheid state to a state in which all members of the population participated in self-government. And of course, in 1989, the communist dictatorships of Eastern Europe collapsed. Of course, the human rights movement was not the sole factor in those transitions. Probably in a lot of cases, it wasn't the dominant factor. But it was a factor in the transitions that took place in different parts of the world during that period. And its ability to challenge those on both sides of the Cold War divide who engaged in repressive activities provided the human rights movement with a standing, a status. It wasn't, there were, of course, those who only denounced leftist regimes and those who only denounced rightist regimes. But the mainstream of the human rights movement was opposed both to right-wing repression and to left-wing repression. Subsequently, in the period since the fall of the dictatorships in Latin America and East Asia, and after the revolutions of 1989 in Eastern Europe, I don't think the human rights movement has been able to play quite so significant a role geopolitically as it played during that earlier period, really at its infancy. But it has maintained a very significant role, and I think there are three issues that it has focused on which have allowed it to play a very significant role. One is that it extended the concept of human rights from the ordinary civilian practices of government to armed conflicts. It took on the role of trying to secure compliance with an older branch of law, international humanitarian law, which regulates conduct in armed conflicts. And since probably the most severe human rights abuses are committed during armed conflict, the role of the human rights movement in documenting abuses in conflict and trying to mitigate those abuses has been immensely important. I think a second issue which has been of central significance to the human rights movement during this period has been securing accountability for past abuses of human rights. And so you have had truth commissions in about 40 countries. We've seen more than 60 heads of state and heads of government prosecuted for either human rights abuses or corruption or a combination of the two in the last 20 years or so. We have seen the development of a number of international criminal tribunals, such as the one, the Special Court for Sierra Leone, which convicted Charles Taylor the other day, and the development of the International Criminal Court. And then I think the third issue, which has been of immense importance in terms of the significance of the human rights movement, is the post 9/11 effort to restrict rights and the resistance of the human rights movement to the kinds of restrictions on rights that have been proposed after 9/11. Certainly, many restrictions of rights have taken place. My own tendency in looking at that situation is to see the glass as half full rather than half empty. That is, one could have anticipated so much worse than has actually taken place. And I think extensive resistance, whether in courts, whether in the legislative branches, whether in the constant denunciations of various kinds of abuses, has actually significantly mitigated the impact of various repressive tendencies that emerged in the wake of 9/11. So obviously those are not the sum total of the role of the activities of the human rights movement, but I think that it has sustained itself, sustained its significance, and is an ongoing force and a force to be reckoned with for a long time to come. So that's my précis.
Well, it's difficult to add very much. Reading your book, a few questions did arise. And first of all, I'd like to take you back into history and look at some of the historical roots of the human rights movement. You wrote very interestingly about the role of natural law.
Yes.
I was wondering, would it be accurate to say that as well as at natural law, Christianity played a large role, and specifically the missionary task of Christianity as seen by missionaries, which in some ways went together also with colonialism, and I'm thinking of Christians in India, British India, wishing to abolish sati and other such things. How important do you think that factor is, the missionary element of Christianity?
It's not a factor that I tried to deal with in the book. In part, I suppose I felt I was somewhat out of my depth in trying to deal with it. I would say that there is that missionary aspect which played an important role, but you know, Christianity is not the only religion that has had a missionary aspect. Islam has certainly had a significant missionary aspect. So I wouldn't put the missionary aspect itself as necessarily the most important factor of Christianity in providing a sort of intellectual and philosophical basis for the emergence of the human rights movement. I think probably ideas about love thy neighbor are more significant as a contribution of Christianity. That is, since I attach a great deal of significance to the altruistic character of the human rights movement. There is in Christianity a significant altruistic factor, and I think that probably was the most important contribution.
But there's another aspect of it which may overlap with natural law a little bit more, which is the belief that the norms and values that you wish to bring to the world are universal ones.
Yes.
And that is fundamental to Christianity.
Yes, and look, you can have spend a long time debating the difference, let's say, between higher law and natural law. And Christianity has this concept of higher law. But I don't think it was Christianity itself. Let me retreat for a moment, because when I think of the people who were involved in the anti-slavery efforts of the 18th century, there's no question but that Quakers, but not only Quakers, somebody like William Wilberforce, acting out of an evangelical Christianity, played a very significant role with respect to the anti-slavery movement.
Yes, the reason I ask the question is that, as you know, that one of the criticisms of international law as a normative exercise is that it does suggest, or does its presupposition is that it is there to apply universal norms.
And, yes.
The criticism from a lot of the weaker countries in the world, in the non-Western countries, is, well, that's all very well to talk about these universal norms. What's universal and who makes these norms? It's the powerful West, and it's the same countries that used to colonize.
But it's also the powerful rulers of those countries who make the argument against universal norms. It's not coming from those who are the victims of the powerful rulers. If Mahathir in Malaysia or the Suharto regime in Indonesia made the argument on behalf of Asian values and against universal norms, or if Lee Kuan Yew made that kind of argument, I'm not sure that would have come from, let's say, political prisoners in Indonesia.
Yes, I hope you understand I'm speaking for the devil here.
No, absolutely.
But to what extent does the fact that the International Criminal Court, for practical reasons and political reasons, can really only go after figures from relatively minor countries make that argument harder in the sense that it's easier for the people who take that view to say, oh, well, it's, you know, you'll never see an American in front of that court, and it's always people from...
I would put it a little bit differently. You won't see an American in front of that court for quite a while. I do think that some of these institutions have to gain credibility over a period of time. In the case of the United States, you know, American exceptionalism has kept the United States out of many international human rights agreements, and when the United States does become a party to them, it's very often very late and with as many exceptions and reservations as can be imagined. So, you know, it was 40 years after the Genocide Convention was adopted by the United Nations that the United States ratified it, and then with all kinds of reservations, which to a significant extent nullify American ratification of the Genocide Convention. But eventually the United States did feel it had to make the gesture of ratifying the Genocide Convention. Eventually the United States did feel it had to make the gesture of ratifying the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And I won't live to see it, but I think that the International Criminal Court eventually will be ratified by the United States.
But even if it's ratified, and I hear the devil is on very thin ice, You'll never see a Russian or never. It's hard to imagine a Russian or a Chinese to appear in front of that court either. And so power politics will always, to some extent, dictate the workings.
Yes, but you know, we came not quite close to having a Russian in front of it, but there was a sort of possibility of it at the time of the Russia-Georgia war. And if I had been the prosecutor for the International Criminal Court, I think ultimately I probably would not have indicted the Russians, because if one were going to do so, one would want a more clear-cut case than that. The statute for the International Criminal Court requires a certain level of gravity with respect to the abuses, and one wouldn't want a debate over whether an indictment met the gravity test. But if there had been a significantly larger number of crimes committed on Georgian territory by the Russians during that war, I think it would have been possible for an indictment to take place.
And Chechnya?
There, the problem is all of the crimes take place on Russian territory, and Russia is not a party to the treaty for the International Criminal Court. Georgia is a party to the treaty, and therefore crimes committed by the Russian troops in Georgia would have been subject to the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. I mean, part of the problem is that the most powerful countries, the United States, China, and Russia, have not ratified the treaty for the International Criminal Court. And so it's only when they commit crimes on the territory of a country that has ratified the treaty that they become subject to its jurisdiction.
Mm. Yes. What about if we talk about the International Criminal Court, and you mentioned genocide? I think I read in your book that you are quite sympathetic towards the right to protect and the right to intervene in cases of, and I think genocide is the criterion you use. What should the criteria be? Where are the sort of yardsticks that one can use for intervention?
Yeah, that's a, I think, a very difficult question. It wasn't called the right to protect at the moment that it took place, but the intervention in Kosovo was an exercise, not right, the responsibility to protect. It was an exercise of that. I think it was legitimate at that moment for NATO, and since it was NATO that that intervened, to say that we have had the recent indication of what Slobodan Milosevic's forces will do in Croatia and Bosnia. Now we have an apparent repetition of those kinds of crimes taking place in Kosovo. Therefore, the basis for intervening seems to me legitimate. That is, there were the actual crimes taking place at the moment of intervention, and what had happened in Bosnia in particular had indicated the extent to which the killing could take place. Whether Bosnia qualified as genocide, it certainly qualified as crimes against humanity. And I don't think it only has to be genocide, which implies an intent to exterminate all or part of the population on racial, religious, or ethnic grounds, but crimes against humanity which don't involve that particular intent, but are very large-scale crimes, are enough of a basis for intervention.
But do you think it might be better to not to talk about genocide at all anymore, since it's so contested? I mean, you in your book, I think, talk about
a small number of times something actually does meet the standard of genocide. I think Rwanda clearly met the standard of genocide, and genocide is the largest crime that we can identify, and when something gets to that point, I think it's appropriate to use that term.
But does Rwanda qualify because of the intent or because of sheer numbers? Because you talk about the gravity and the numbers.
I think it requires both. I think it requires both the intent and a very large scale. I think that where you have, let's say, an intent to kill people because of their race or religion, and you kill five people, I don't think it's appropriate to use a term such as genocide. The concept of extermination is also part of the definition of genocide.
Yeah, I think in the Genocide Convention they don't talk about numbers, do they? I
mean, there's no, there's no attempt to quantify, but there is the reference to exterminate in whole or in part, and the idea of extermination implies substantial numbers.
Mm-hmm. And on that, on a related topic, somebody told me the other day that you were partly responsible for the for a certain number of Jews becoming neocons in the Skokie case. Two questions. First of all, is it true that the Skokie case, which everybody here probably would be aware of, when you stood up for the right of neo-Nazis to stage a demonstration in a largely Jewish suburb of Chicago, that was indeed, as well as the school in Brooklyn, I believe, a catalyst for some people to turn to the neocons who felt betrayed by this?
Look, I'm speaking out of interest, so I can be discounted for what I say. But Skokie was quite peculiar. That is, it aroused immense antagonism for a relatively brief period. That is, there were people who were horrified at the position that the American Civil Liberties Union adopted, that I adopted in defending freedom of speech for the neo-Nazis. That turned around, and I would say that there is widespread agreement today, which would extend to neocons, that the ACLU did the right thing in Skokie, that it was one of those events. It wasn't enormously important legally. It didn't set any great precedent. But when Americans think about freedom of speech, often their attitude is, well, if the Nazis could march in Skokie, I guess so-and-so can be accepted or tolerated. And neocons will take that position as well as anybody else. I think the issues that had a deeper impact in developing the neocon movement were often race issues in the United States, and to a somewhat more limited extent, foreign policy issues, military issues. I think that policy towards Israel was also a significant factor in developing the neocon movement in the United States. But there is a wider acceptance of freedom of speech for everyone in the United States today than I think than at any time previously. And I think there are very few places in the world where the acceptance of freedom of speech is as great as in the United States. We haven't had, in the post 9/11 period, we haven't had significant backsliding on freedom of speech. There has been, you know, one bad U.S. Supreme Court decision, a Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project. But other than that, that's really exceptional. The commitment to freedom of speech has been very substantially maintained in the United States. And let's say the Bush administration did not attack freedom of speech.
Times change, though. Do you think, would you still be so sanguine if, let's say, a group naming itself a jihadi group were to announce that they were going to stage a demonstration in the vicinity of the downtown New York?
Well, that was the argument against the
infidels.
That was the argument against the mosque.
Yes, but that wasn't nearly as provocative as a group shouting "death to the infidels" in the same place.
I think that Americans have, to a quite surprising extent, surprising to me, because when I started working on freedom of speech issues half a century ago, public attitudes were very hostile to freedom of speech for left-wingers in particular. I do think that there has been a very substantial evolution of public opinion in the United States on freedom of speech issues, and I think the significance of Skokie is that it contributed to that. When I used to speak on the Skokie case, and at the time the case was going on, I spoke on it, it seemed to me, every evening, and sometimes two or three times a day. And one of the questions I would ask people was, how many of you have gotten into dinner table debates about Skokie? And almost every hand in the audience would go up. And I had the impression during that period that over time, the free speech argument got more and more support in the course of those dinner table arguments. It proved to be, from a freedom of speech standpoint, probably the single most valuable educational effort that certainly I was ever involved in.
Shifting continents a little bit, in terms of human rights, why do you say in your book that you think China is moving in the right direction?
No, I'm ambivalent on China. I'd say that for every three steps forward, there are two steps backward in China.
What's the one step forward?
I think the not not something coming from the regime. What I would rather say is that within the citizenry in China, there seems to be a greater willingness to espouse rights than there has been in the past. Really very much an admirer of a lot of Chinese journalists. It seems to me that they are constantly engaged in struggles to expand the range of issues they cover and to go into greater depth in the issues that they cover. I've attended meetings of Chinese editors in which they talk about having to remain at their desks until 11 o'clock at night because they have to argue with the propaganda ministry about what is going to appear in the next morning's newspaper. But they do argue. And my impression of the Chinese journalists is they don't go like that against the regime. They go, they look for byways. They don't want confrontations, but they are trying very hard to expand coverage. You know, so whether it's something like the poor construction in Sichuan, which led to the collapse of the schools at the time of the earthquake, or if you go back, you know, a number of years to the appearance of the SARS epidemic and the role of the press in China in ferreting out the SARS epidemic and making it known and forcing the Chinese government to acknowledge the SARS epidemic and that way preventing it from becoming a worldwide plague. That there is that kind of effort by Chinese journalists. And so whether rights are protected is not only a function of the regime, it also is to a very large extent the question of the assertion of rights. And my impression is that Chinese journalists in particular are in the forefront of trying to assert rights. Some Chinese lawyers also play that role. So we've had, you know, the drama in the last several days of the blind lawyer, Chen Guangcheng. He's not alone. There are a lot of, China doesn't have, compared to the United States, a very large number of lawyers. It's a very small profession compared to a country like the United States. But a significant number of Chinese lawyers do seem to try to play a role defending rights.
Yes, that's true. I mean, it's the American conservatives have long argued, and it's a very questionable assertion, but that capitalism brings and expands rights and brings more democracy and so on. Could one, at least if you narrow this argument down, say that more capitalism, more commercial competition in China has actually contributed to the positive effects of what you're just talking about? In other words, scandal sells.
I don't think so.
Well, but the newspapers that often expose scandals do so because they know it sells more copies.
My contacts with Chinese journalists, and you know, I had lunch the other day with three Chinese journalists, including a woman who's a you know very well known editor in China, and my sense of them is that they are determined to be good professionals. And this is that expanding coverage and deepening coverage is an aspect of that desire for professionalism. And I feel the same way about the lawyers. I've attended training programs for legal aid lawyers in China. And there's, you know, a very famous defense attorney named Mo Xiaoping. And watching him speak to 100 legal aid lawyers, to say that you could hear a pin drop, I mean, the rapt attention, the determination to try to learn from him seemed to me overwhelming. And the legal aid lawyers, you know, aren't doing anything of commercial significance. They're paid, you know, trivial amounts of money. And yet, they do seem, you know, they come to their position, you know, with no basis whatsoever. They've attended, they've studied law as undergraduates. They're sort of, they go into a legal aid office with no idea how to represent a criminal defendant. But when they had a chance to listen to somebody who knew how to represent a criminal defendant, there was a determination to learn. And that aspect of a desire for professionalism has been immensely impressive to me.
Mm-hmm. How much time do you have for questions?
10 more minutes than we'll
take. Do you see similar developments in countries like Egypt? Similar figures coming up?
You know, I've traveled in Egypt a lot less than I have I've traveled in China, and I've had much less exposure to the kinds of people I'm talking about in the Chinese context. So the fact that that I don't see it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It may simply reflect the limits on what I have been able to observe in Egypt. I was by accident a witness to the first demonstration going towards Tahrir Square, and that was an enlightening experience, because it was, you know, quite obvious to me watching that demonstration. I was staying at a hotel. We had a conference in a hotel with huge windows directly overlooking the paths that the demonstrators were going on, and it was very clear to me watching that demonstration that somebody had organized that demonstration with great care in advance, even to the point where, as the demonstrators approached a line of police directly below the hotel, the demonstrators lifted their hands like that to show that they weren't carrying any weapons. I mean, that was an old sort of you know, tactic from the civil rights movement, and it went back in the United States to a man named A.J. Mustey, who was the principal anti-war figure in the United States long ago. So somebody had sort of learned all those methods, and people had been very well prepared. Mm-hmm. But I've had glimpses of things in Egypt. I don't have a depth of knowledge.
I must ask you one more question before we throw it open to other questions. Something that I already admired you greatly, but made me admire you even more.
Okay.
When I was told the other day that you were preparing an article about pornography, and in order to prepare this article, you read the complete works of Balzac. Is this true, and why Balzac?
Not the complete works, by any means. I'm not prepared.
Why Balzac?
there was a particular novel by Balzac, which the French word that is used in the title is ténébreuse, and it may be translated, you know, a murky affair or something like that. About half the book is given over to Balzac's analysis of the argot of the demi-monde, it's great stuff. I enjoyed reading it, I don't know how I discovered that particular novel by Balzac, but I had a good time.
I'll take any questions right in the back.
Side of the devil for a moment, Arye. How would you assess the critique of the human rights movement, particularly in the former communist bloc, as basically having failed to live up to its promise? That human rights activists, as you noted, were somewhat artificially inflated in importance by the West as a result of Cold War politics. And after the collapse of communism, they failed to translate human rights principles into politics. That many of the countries in the region quickly spawned repressive regimes just as repressive as the ones that existed.
I don't think just under, as repressive.
Well,
I don't think...
And that, just one more point, yeah. That the human rights activists today are fairly marginalized and are largely reliant on the support of the Open Society Foundations and other outsiders to sustain their work.
Look, I think that the critique has merit. There should have been much higher level of engagement, but I don't think that it's appropriate to consider the regimes comparable to what existed previously. Even if you take something like the Putin regime in Russia, where everything is organized to maintain his political power, nevertheless, you don't have people being sent off for long prison terms for speaking critically of the government. People can travel from one part of the country to the other. They can travel internationally. They can have associations with the West. There's an awful long way to go in a country like Russia in protecting human rights. And clearly there have been murders of journalists, murders of human rights activists. That have taken place in Russia. There are terrible abuses committed on an ongoing basis in a region like Chechnya. And yet even with all the abuses that do exist in Russia, I don't think it should be equated with the abusiveness of the old Soviet regime. And to a certain extent, one has to say that the capacity to protect human rights can't only emanate from outside. Outside, one can document the abuses, one can criticize the abuses, one can support those who try to defend human rights. But there has to be, from within the country, a significant movement to protect rights. In some respects, I would contrast China and Russia. China seems to me far more repressive than Russia today. The you couldn't have an episode like this Guancheng case in Russia. But you also sense in China, or I sense in China, a more widespread demand for rights than I sense in Russia today. And the fact that there is not a more powerful human rights movement within the country is a significant part of the reason that rights are not better protected in Russia.
Which is the reverse of what it used to be, because before the fall of the communist regime, there was far more activism in Russia than there was in China.
Yes, there was far more activism. Look, one of the things that happened in the Soviet bloc countries, and I think we need to recognize this, is that the West won the Cold War. The Reaganite kind of explanation for that seems to me somewhat silly. But I think a different explanation that I would offer, or at least one factor in the explanation, is that the United States in particular was very effective in getting across the view that political freedom and economic prosperity went hand in hand. And so when you had various protests against the regime, I don't think you could have separated the concern for political freedom from the concern for economic prosperity. They were seen to some degree as one and the same thing. I think that was probably more true in Eastern Europe than it was in Russia. And in Eastern Europe, there was also, an anti-colonial element. It was not just denial of political freedom, but it was denial of political freedom due to the power of the colonizer of Eastern Europe, the Soviet Union. So there were all these factors about economic prosperity, political freedom, an anti-colonial element that all were sort of tied together and helped to bring about the protests against against communism.
It's coming.
At Human Rights Watch, there have periodically been discussions about the idea of economic human rights and whether or not there should be something set up to advocate for that parallel to political human rights. And I understand why. Human Rights Watch would want.
And I'm considered an arch reactionary on that front.
All right. Well, I don't know the ins and outs, but do you feel that I understand why Human Rights Watch would want to keep its mission in on that dimension? But do you think that it would be valuable and useful and productive to have a parallel economic rights movement that would set up in a similar way and be advocating in countries that people should have a basic level?
Yeah, there are various groups that have organized around the idea of economic rights. And I would say that today, most human rights organizations, at least rhetorically, embrace the idea of economic rights. They don't devote a great deal of their activity to it, but they proclaim a commitment to economic rights. Look, my own view of this is I espouse economic justice. I don't espouse economic rights. The difference between the two is that if I favor economic justice, I favor more equitable distribution of the benefits and resources of society. But I think that has to take place through a variety of trade-offs and through the political process. My attitude towards rights is rights have to be very strong. They have to trump all other concerns. So that I don't want trade-offs on freedom of speech or the right not to be tortured, or something of that sort. That is, no matter how offensive what I have to say is, I think I should be able to say it. If the state has an overwhelming desire to get information from me, I don't think it ought to be able to torture me in order to get that information. So taking that very strong stand on rights, I can't take that approach with respect to what are called economic rights, because necessarily there are questions of resources. There have to be debates as to how much one gets in terms of income or anything else, and I don't think one can solve those problems through assertions about rights. So I can advocate for, let's say, a changed tax system so as to promote more economic justice, but I don't feel I can deal with a subject like that by claiming that there are rights that are involved. I don't think it lends itself to the concept of rights.
Okay, well, I don't think it would be necessarily like on a tax system issue, but more like, you know, basic access to not go to not starve, to not have children who are hungry, to have access to clean water and so on and so forth.
No, but let's take that example of access to clean water. Many people worldwide do not have access to clean water. In order to give them clean water, vast resources would have to be deployed. If you take China, for example, you've had this immense improvement in some respects in terms of the standard of living. That is a huge economic headway in China. But in China, that has been accompanied by a great deterioration in access to clean water. You know, the northern part of the country is, to a significant extent, running out of water. The Yellow River is a dead river in China. In Beijing, they have to go deeper and deeper in terms of wells to try to get water for the residents of Beijing. And so the consequence of the immense economic headway in China is a disastrous impact on access to clean water. And probably there are very significant health consequences in China as a result of the denial of access to clean water. Now, one has to somewhere strike a balance, it seems to me, between getting people clean water and allowing the significant economic headway that has been made in China to take place, because as a result of the economic headway, people have less clean water, but they have more food, they have better housing, they have better clothing in China. That's what I mean by trade-offs. How you resolve a question like that doesn't seem to me susceptible of you can't resolve that question through assertions about rights. One economic benefit ends up being disastrous so far as another economic benefit is concerned.
Okay, I'll take this up with you later.
Yes.
Thanks. Aria, you cited as one of the three main developments for the human rights movement a focus on enforcement and understanding of humanitarian law or the
yes.
laws of war. And I wonder if you could reflect on the challenge for the human rights movement now during a period where we seem to have slipped into somewhat of a perpetual state of war. I mean, as important as the laws of war are in protecting civilians and all of that, the fact is that they permit an awful lot of brutality, frankly, and things we would never tolerate during what we used to call peacetime. But now we seem to have drifted into somewhat of a perpetual state of war. And while it's never been the province of the human rights movement to say when war starts and finishes, we seem to have a new challenge now in terms of which standards apply.
I'm not sure that I would agree historically that this question of perpetual war is a larger problem than in the past. You know, we did have in the post-World War II era very substantial wars. We had the Korean War, we had the Vietnam War, we had the Iran-Iraq war, and the many millions of people who were killed in that war. We had a tremendous number of wars that took place in Africa, in South Asia, Southeast Asia. You think of the war for the independence of Bangladesh and the vast number of killings and horrendous abuses that took place in that war. I think what you're actually pointing to is that we have a higher level of consciousness today of the victimization of civilians in a number of the conflicts that are underway, and that to a significant extent today, as was not the case previously, our thinking about the wars that continue to take place, such as the war in Afghanistan, is very much shaped by our awareness of the civilian victims. The civilian victims weren't a big focus of public thinking, let's say, at the time of the Korean War. That concern with civilian victims is a much more recent phenomenon, and to some extent, I think it is a consequence of the focus of the human rights movement on what takes place in armed conflict. One of the things I feel very good about in terms of Human Rights Watch during my period is that it played a significant role in initiating concern with violations of the laws of armed conflict, and it has continued that focus. But I think a valuable innovation is the work that is being done by a tiny organization that I'm very fond of called CIVIC, the Campaign for Innocent Victims in Conflict, which has been engaged in this effort to get armed forces to pay damages to the families of civilians who are killed in armed conflict. And I think there is something like that continues to raise consciousness within the militaries themselves about the need to protect civilians against armed conflict. So there's a lot more to be done in this field than has been done until now. But I actually don't think that the situation is worse than it was previously. I don't have figures to reel off, I think if one, were to examine it the way, let's say, Stephen Pinker does in his book about the, this long-term reduction in violence, you might come to some somewhat surprising results.
One quick follow-up. I actually am more concerned, not so much, I agree with you on all of that, actually. My concern is more that what does it mean for us that, if, as now seems to be the case, the U.S. will be withdrawing from Afghanistan in 2014. We're in a situation where it's still quite a serious possibility that even after that, the United States will think of itself and project itself as a nation at war because of the so-called war on terrorism. And that's the concern I have about what does that mean for those of us in the human rights movement when we're looking at the questions of which laws apply.
Elisa, your job will not be done. You have to keep at it. You've got a long way to go. One doesn't achieve permanent victories in efforts on behalf of human rights. There are always more and more challenges to be faced. In general, I don't share the view that things have gotten worse.
I think we have time for two more questions.
I am from Kyrgyzstan. What's your opinion about human rights issue in our country after two revolutions? You know that...
Which country?
Kyrgyzstan, Central Asia.
Kyrgyzstan.
Kyrgyzstan, Central Asia, yes. What do you think about human rights issue in our country? Because you know that Arab Spring followed after our revolution.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Although I don't think there's a cause and effect relationship between the two. I had thought of Kyrgyzstan as the country in Central Asia that was most promising. Then was somewhat shocked, or more than shocked, by the violence in the south involving the Uzbek minority in the south of the country. Clearly there are significant human rights issues that have to be addressed in Kyrgyzstan as they have to be addressed elsewhere, but at the same time, it's a country that, in its neighborhood, looks relatively good from a human rights standpoint.
David,
we'll have one more then. I've done my devil's advocate role too many times with you to repeat it this evening. But unlike Ian, I'm actually sincere about it. I'd like you to do is take up the response you made to Elisa, which is to say there are no permanent victories. To take up the response, excuse me, that you just made, that there are no permanent victories in human rights. And do talk, if you would, for a couple of minutes about where you think things are going rather than how they go up there.
I'm disappointed by a number of developments, and I'm encouraged by a few other developments. I'm very disappointed by developments in Europe. I think the rise of xenophobia and racism in Europe is a very serious setback for human rights. I think the advent of the current government in Hungary is a particularly repugnant development. I don't know how things will be in with the new leadership in France. I hope that some of the easy espousal of racism associated with Sarkozy will diminish in France, but the fact that Marine Le Pen was able to get about 18% of the vote in France is not encouraging. I think the end of the Berlusconi era in Italy was a more favorable development, and I hope that the tide of racism and xenophobia in Italy will diminish. The fact that these sort of racist movements have even emerged in the Scandinavian countries and in the Netherlands, the countries which we thought were the sort of paradise for human rights, is quite dispiriting. I think in the United States, I'm disappointed that the Obama administration has been so resolute about not looking backward to the abuses of the previous government, and it has sort of held the line on human rights. Since coming into office, I don't know what will happen after the fall elections. On the other hand, if you look at some other parts of the world, I'm encouraged by developments in West Africa, that you now have several countries in West Africa that have rights-respecting democratic governments in a territory where horrendous abuses of human rights took place not that long ago. I don't know what the outcome will be of the Arab revolutions. I'm very optimistic about developments in Tunisia. I'm not optimistic about developments in a lot of the other countries in the Arab region. I think one gets a sort of mixed picture as one looks around the world at various developments. There are things that are going in the right direction, and there are things that are going in the wrong direction. The problems in Europe, I think, are very serious because, if the United States does not play a leadership role with respect to rights, and I don't think it is likely that the United States will play a leadership role with respect to rights in the period ahead. One would have hoped that that would emanate from Europe. That kind of hope doesn't seem realistic in the current context. So if I look to where leadership has to come from, I actually think it has to come from the non-governmental human rights movement, that it has more of a role than individual governments or associations of states in protecting rights.
Maybe it'll come from the Germans and the Japanese. One more question.
I know that you and OSI have been very involved in Romani rights for a long time. Roma rights and Romani rights. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you see the status of Roma rights today and how you see one, being able to help the everyday Roma, I mean, in Eastern Europe most obviously, but also here and in other places, move forwards in their status.
Look, again, there are contradictory developments so far as Roma rights are concerned. There does seem to be a higher level of outspoken prejudice against the Roma today, both in Eastern Europe and some countries of Western Europe. than in the past. And when I spoke of Berlusconi, I had in mind some of the attacks on Roma in Italy, and Sarkozy was also unfortunate with respect to Roma. On the other hand, one does see the emergence of greater capacity within the Roma population itself, and that probably translates into a greater ability to become advocates for their own rights. And I think in terms of the role of the Open Society Foundations, our role has on the one hand been to defend Roma rights, but I think it has been to a larger extent, a much larger extent, an effort to enhance capacity within the Roma communities themselves. And I think that is a successful effort, and over the long term will pay off in significant ways in enhancing the protection of Roma rights.
Thank you very much.
So thank you, Ian, and thank you, Ari, for the very reflective and thoughtful and somewhat surprising point on Balzac. But I'd like to ask my close colleagues, Amy Yankin and Ricardo Castro, if they would come up for a second for their own sort of surprising and unpredictable presentation.
Okay, wait, hold on. Just leave it in there for a minute. Yeah. Hi, good evening. My name is Ricardo Castro, and this is my colleague, Amy Yankin. And we wanted to just take this opportunity to, on behalf of the staff of OSI, to express our affection and appreciation for Arié's leadership as president of OSI. As you may know, Arié steps down from that position at the end of June. And so we were looking for a sort of modest way that wouldn't embarrass Arié too terribly to express that affection and appreciation. And as you may know, we have a documentary photography program at OSI, which Amy heads up, and we have an exhibition that's up currently, and one of the featured series of photographs deals with Burma. And it is a series of portraits that were taken of different activists and civil society actors, many of whom we have supported over the years. And on the hand of each person in the portrait appears the name of someone who, when the photo was taken, was in prison in Burma as a political prisoner. Happily, many of the people whose names are written on those hands today are now free, thanks to the reforms. Arié made a probably very casual comment to Amy about one of the images, and that gave us an idea that perhaps we could give him that image. So,
before I take out the image, I just want to say that in presenting the image, I feel that it symbolizes the values and principles that the foundation has embodied. So it therefore feels very fitting to be able to present it to Arié on behalf of the entire staff, really in celebration of his lifelong commitment to human rights.
And we have measured the print, so it'll fit his new office in our new office space.
Thank you. No, that particular photo gets me every time I pass it on the stairs. So I thank you very much. I am deeply appreciative.
We hope it will haunt you for years.
Okay, thank you.